The lecture which follows is by Tom Carey. It was given in New York on the 25th February, 1965. The subject of the lecture is the progressive labor movement.
Years ago, for some time after the split, it published no programmatic document which defined or attempted to define its relation to Stalinism on a world scale. I think that came only several years after its formation. When the Trotskyists broke from the Communist Party, or were expelled from the Communist Party in 1928, we went through a period of some 5 years in which we concentrated on clarifying all of the theoretical, political, strategical, and tactical questions which divided us from the Stalinist tendency, which was then the major tendency in the Communist International. The first issue of the Militant carried the beginning of a document which was a basic criticism of the political program adopted by the Sixth World Congress of the Communist International in 1928. Remember, the Communist International did not formally adopt a world program until 1928. That was 11 years after the October Revolution, in which it formally incorporated, among other things, the theory of socialism in a single country, which then became the real dividing line, theoretically, between the Bolshevik-Leninist, or the Marxist tendency, and the revisionist, or Stalinist tendency. And Stalinism has been characterized by its revisionism since the very beginning, although some of the new theoreticians that have emerged think that it only developed after the 20th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union with the Khrushchev speech, which is not true. The theory of socialism in a single country constituted a departure, a principal departure from Marxism, which is above all an internationalist political current. We begin from our analysis of the whole international world, capitalism, from the very beginning, and set forth the perspective of overthrowing capitalism on a world scale. That did not mean, as some of the vulgarists interpreted it, Trotsky's theory of permanent revolution, that the revolution would have to occur simultaneously in all of the countries of the world, otherwise it would not be dignified by the name of socialist revolution. No, Trotsky was very careful to point out that while the revolution could and would begin in one or another country, that it could not end within the boundaries of a single country or a single group of countries, but must continue until it prevails on a world scale and becomes established then as the world socialist society. And the Bolsheviks all considered that the October Revolution was the beginning, that the Soviet Union was the fortress from which would then extend the revolutionary conquests of October to Europe and then on a world scale, in line not with Trotsky's theory but with Marx's theory and concept. It was Marx who first projected the idea of the revolution in permanence, and he did that in 1850. That is over 115 years ago. Trotsky developed this concept of Marx on the basis of the further experience of the struggle before, during, and after the First World War. At any rate, For 5 years, we engaged in a concentrated propaganda campaign in which all of these questions were raised for analysis and examination in order to develop a cadre which was steeled in the basic theory of the Marxist movement and which embodied in itself the very essence of internationalism based upon the concept of the permanent revolution. There was never any question about, nor did we deny, what our origin was. But there was never any question about what the theoretical, strategic, and tactical differences were that divided us from the official Stalinist movement. Now, that's in line with Leninism and with Marxism, which begins with the program, always. You begin with the program, and on the basis of the program, you recruit your cadre. We conceive of the Leninist Party, the Bolshevik Party, as a homogeneous party. That doesn't mean monolithic. There's a very important distinction between the two. Homogeneous in the sense that the party recruits its members on the basis of agreement on a basic program and rejects those who do not agree with the program. That doesn't mean there aren't differences, very often deep and important differences over strategy and tactics and even over questions of principle, which develop in the course of the life of the party, as we well know, and often result in splits. But it means that the party program is based upon this analysis of the world as it exists, that is, it's internationalist to its core. We begin with the international program, the national program. We go on from there and develop our strategy and tactics in line with the principles enunciated in our program. We say this is the way Marxists or revolutionaries begin. Now, one of the unique characteristics of the Trotskyist movement was that it was the only tendency, to my knowledge, that broke with the Stalinist movement that ever followed this course. I can't recall a single other tendency that split from the American Communist Party, or even internationally, that followed the course of subjecting to a thorough analysis the differences based upon the world program and concept of permanent revolution. If you recall, right after the Trotskyists were expelled from the American Communist Party, the Lovestoneites were expelled. The Lovestoneites were in the leadership of the American Communist Party when we were expelled. Their expulsion was followed also with the establishment of a rival organization and a rival newspaper. They called themselves the right opposition as opposed to the left opposition, the left Trotskyist opposition. The right opposition in the Soviet Union was led by Bukharin. But contrary to the course followed by the left opposition, they never made any attempt to analyze the roots of the degeneration in the Soviet Union, to counterpose a course based upon a developed world outlook different than that of the Communist International that existed at that time. Their line was that of reforming the Communist International. That is, of returning it to what they considered the true course, the course followed by Bukharin and Stalin prior to the break which occurred after the Sixth World Congress. And it was based almost entirely upon tactical, strategical criticisms. American exceptionalism was one of his, one of Lovestone's contributions, and such was the character of the group. The result being, as while they made a much bigger splash in the beginning than the left opposition, that is, they had a much larger group to begin with and much more prominent people than the left opposition or the Communist League, they didn't last very long. Their organization was formally dissolved, I think, sometime during the war, or even prior to it. I just can't remember. And Lovestone, as you know, wound up as Meany's, first as Dubinsky's hatchet man in the Garment Workers Union, and now as Meany's expert on international relations, in which he's become a finger man, an informer, a stool pigeon, and a think for the American State Department. Brown, another very prominent Lovestoneite, is a State Department representative, one of those who split the European trade union movement after the Second World War. That was his great contribution to the development of the socialist revolution in Europe. And he is still sort of a fireman, going around trying to extinguish the beginning of any spark of opposition to the American State Department policy. Bertram Wolfe, I suppose you all know Bertram Wolfe and what his contribution has been since the split. Now he's writing books and has emerged as an academic authority on Bolshevism, and his contribution is an extension of the theory that Stalinism was an inevitable outgrowth of Bolshevism, and that Leninism inevitably leads to Stalinism, to monolithism, and to bureaucratism. And he develops that in a whole series of publications. They didn't last very long, and their demise could have been predicted from the very beginning when they refused to engage in what was absolutely necessary, that is to clean out the Augean stables of Stalinism, the theoretical and strategical and tactical rubbish which had accumulated around the Communist International under the rule of Stalin. After that, all of the splits and splitlets, until the 20th Congress, were all splits in which those who left the Communist Party avowed their loyalty and fealty to the Kremlin. They said, yes, Stalin and the Russian Communist Party are Marxist revolutionists. They're all right. It's only the American Party that's gone off the course. And the reason they get away with it is that Stalin really doesn't know what's going on here. And the moment Stalin finds out, why, then these people will be out and we will be in. That was the almost inevitable course of all of these tendencies. I remember, especially after the ouster of Browder, there were a number of splits in the Communist Party and criticisms directed against Foster by Dunn and William Dunn and others of that character, who had been leaders in the Communist Party, some of them founders of the Communist Party in 1919. And that was their whole line, that the American Communist Party, they said, carrying this analysis to an extreme, They contended the American Communist Party was led by agents of the FBI, that the whole Central Committee of the Communist Party, they asserted, was staffed by agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And poor Stalin, he didn't know this, and they were out to inform them of it. Some even went to Moscow in order to get to the ear of Stalin. Of course, they never got near Stalin, but probably did talk to some of the others. And they sputtered along for a while and disappeared. They published them pamphlets, and they published papers, and they attacked the American Communist Party from the left. These were the all that I can recall were considered themselves to the left of the American Communist Party and had many cogent criticisms of it, but never were able to break the umbilical cord that tied them to Stalinism, in the sense that they continued to view Stalin and Stalinism and the Soviet Union and the world as the true and representative Marxist revolutionary current. And it was over that dilemma that they broke their heads. Most of them just disappeared. I don't know if a single one of them has remained inside any of the existing tendencies of the radical movement. You can't play games with history, as many of these tendencies have discovered after they had dissolved. We had similar tendencies in the Trotskyist movement. One of the most notorious was that of the Cochranites, if you remember. They split and they from the very beginning, didn't publicly disassociate themselves from Trotskyism, but tried to pretend that they were something else. What else? Nobody knew. They began publishing a magazine which was open to all kinds of individuals representing diverse tendencies. They eschewed the formation of any organization. They broke with the Fourth International and set out to build a native, genuine socialist movement, broad and all-inclusive, and wound up after a few years in dissolving their magazine and going out of business. The Shachmanites in 1939, the main question which divided us at that time was the question of our differences over the class character of the Soviet Union and everything that flowed from it. And they set out to develop a new theory. That is the theory of bureaucratic collectivism, to replace the concept developed by Trotsky of the degenerated workers' state. And a new program of practical activities based upon it, and for a time they cut themselves a big swath. Now, if you remember, they took practically all of the intellectuals out of the Socialist Workers' Party, all the editors of the magazine and the newspaper, all of the writers and all of the thinkers and all of the cogitators. And they thought that gave them a tremendous advantage over the SWP, but what they did not have was the program. They rejected the old program and tried to develop and formulate a new one, but never did quite succeed in doing so. And finally, they wound up re-entering the Socialist Party, where they became part of the extreme right wing of the Socialist Democracy. Now, this question, which we have often been criticized for emphasizing, that is, the whole question of Stalinism and the class character of the Soviet Union, has proven to be, over the years, one of the most decisive questions, dividing the political tendencies in the world movement. Trotsky's great contribution to the theoretical discussion of the developments in the Soviet Union was his analysis of the bureaucracy and his conclusion that this bureaucracy that developed on the basis of the great October Revolution constituted a bureaucratic caste that had usurped the political power and authority of the working class and had arrogated to itself the privileges and the power that goes with a bureaucratic caste. And he explained the reasons for it: the backwardness of the Soviet Union, surrounded by a world of imperialist reaction, forced back upon itself, the tremendous casualties in the World War I and in the Civil War, the decimation of a large part of the Bolshevik Party, of the fighters who had played the role of both political and military leaders, who were in the front ranks of the newly created Red Army against the counter-revolution. All of these factors which created a condition of weariness in the masses in the Soviet Union and laid the basis for the Stalinist reaction. But he said that this bureaucracy rests upon a workers' state. That is, the basic conquest of the October Revolution still prevails. The overthrow of capitalist property relations and property forms, the nationalization of industry, the monopoly of foreign trade, and the planned economy. He said these are the basic conquests of the October Revolution. These are what characterize it as a social revolution. That is, a fundamental transformation of the property forms and property relations with which one must begin. You cannot begin to talk about socialism unless you first have succeeded in overthrowing or eliminating the capitalist forms and property relations of class society based upon them and the capitalist competition, the free market, free enterprise, and so forth and so on. That the basic transformation must take place in the economic structure. And upon the basis of this transformation, a new state, a new state form, a new type of government arises, which was the Soviet government, healthy and progressive in its initial period, but under the development of the reaction and Stalinism, which became a reactionary excrescence on the progressive conquest of the October Revolution. That these two things, this theoretical development, was the only real solution to the problem that all tendencies had been grappling with. What is this thing that we have in the Soviet Union? Certainly it did not follow the norm which had been projected by all of the classical thinkers of Marxism. Nobody had ever projected the idea of a state, a workers' state, being established through a social revolution going through a process of degeneration. The assumption was, and this was general, that once the revolution would begin, and that it would probably begin in one of the more advanced industrial countries, that this would only be the beginning, and that the state would begin to wither away as the revolutionary conquests extended beyond the borders of the country in which it began, and that force and repression, which are characteristic of class society, of the domination of a minority over a majority, would begin to weaken because there would be no necessity of such domination once class exploitation and class oppression had been eliminated. So the state would begin to, as Engels said, to begin to wither away. and that more and more the functions of the state apparatus and the apparatchniks would be that of administrators instead of rulers over the people. And as Lenin put it, every cook could be a minister of the state. Now, this did not occur, instead of which we saw a monstrous growth of the state authority and a monstrous increase in exploitation and oppression. Not exploitation, labor exploitation, but the appropriation, exploitation in the sense of the appropriation by the bureaucracy of an inordinate amount of the surplus value created by the labor of the workers. And so people, a lot of people began to ask, what is it? And they turned their back on it. They rejected it. They said, this is not what we had been promised. This is not what would have been set forth by the great Marxist thinkers. This is not a workers' state. Workers have no power. They have no authority. This is God only knows what. Some people began to call it state capitalism. And some people began to call it bureaucratic collectivism. And we had a discussion at the very founding of the Socialist Workers' Party, prior to the founding convention in 1938, where if the bulletins are available, they are very interesting to see how many different positions, even at that time, after Trotsky had made his analysis, how many different positions there were on the class character of the state. I think they encompassed every conceivable position, with the even bureaucratic collectivists. Fascism, some of people insisted upon characterizing it as fascism because fascism also, if you remember, in Italy, the cooperative state, he ostensibly set out to expropriate the individual capitalists in the name of the state. The state was to operate all of the enterprises. And superimposed upon this state was this monstrous, repressive, fascist regime, both in Italy and in the Germany. And they began to point out the similarities between the two and therefore concluded that what you had there was fascism. Well, we went through, as I say, that struggle and many others. And this is one of the important contributions made by our movement. Now, another extension of that analysis was the character of the communist parties outside of the Soviet Union, such as the Communist Party of the USA. And we had always that problem. What explained? What explanation was there for the zigzags that the Communist Party made? And some of them very violent zigzags. Why did it at one time carry out one policy, at another time a completely diametrically opposed policy? What is it that motivated them? What is it that determined these frenetic turns in policy? Characteristic of Stalinism in its functioning in those countries outside of the Soviet Union. And there again, the Trotskyists provided the fundamental analysis that with the degeneration of the Soviet Union, that is its governmental form, the bureaucracy, the rise of the bureaucracy, the Communist International itself became bureaucratized. And they established it as a monolithic organization in which all sections of the Communist International received their directions from the Communist International, which in turn had a pipeline directly to the Kremlin. And that this theory of socialism in a single country inevitably led to the subordination of the interests of the workers in all other sections of the country to the supposed goal and objective of building socialism in the Soviet Union. So if there was a revolutionary development, say, in any area of the world, which did not conform to the concept of dealing or threatened or in the eyes of the bureaucracy in the Kremlin, raised the danger of intervention, of war, of creating a chaotic situation in which the Soviet Union would become involved. The policy of the Communist International was to utilize all of these developments and all of these parties as sort of frontier guards for the Soviet Union. They said the object, the duty, the obligation of the individual Communist parties was to prevent attack on the Soviet Union by the imperialist powers, and that everything else is subordinated to it, even, as I say, the crushing of revolution. And so the twists and turns could only be explained by extensions of the diplomatic policy of the Kremlin as applied at any given historical moment. At one time it was collective security, at another time it was the third period insanity of the United Front from below. Another time it was joining the League of Nations. Another time it was People's Frontism. All of these zigzags back and forth could be explained only if you began with the understanding that these policies were not arrived at independently by the Communist parties outside of the Soviet Union, but were part and parcel of an extension of the diplomatic line, diplomatic policy of the Kremlin at any given moment. Because regardless of national peculiarities, you'll find that all of these terms were carried out almost in military precision in all parts of the world. So when you had a united front from below in Germany, which led to the victory of Hitler, you had a united front from below here in independent trade unions in America, you had it in France, you had it in Italy, you had it in Latin America, you had it in Asia, you had it all over the world. This was the policy. And when you had the People's Front, regardless of what the situation may have been or the differences in various countries, you had the People's Front on a world scale, everywhere throughout the world. This was the only logical and correct explanation of all of these zigzags. But you have to begin, you see, you have to begin with an analysis of what is Stalinism, what is the Soviet Union, and the relation between Stalinism in the Soviet Union and its manifestations on a national scale. Now, I give you this background because it's only against this background that you can't begin. You can even begin to judge both the character, the direction, and the development of any tendency that originates in the Communist Party. Because all these tendencies, especially after 1933, were schooled in Stalinist mythology. They all accepted the theory of socialism in a single country. They all accepted the infallibility of Stalin. This is until the 20th Congress. They all called what they had in the Soviet Union, socialism, and so forth and so on down the line. They all accepted the People's Frontism when that became the line, and it continued the line after 1935 with a very slight hiatus in the period immediately following the Cold War in 1946 to about 1950. Well, now let's examine progressive labor with this background. They came out of the Communist Party. I say, in reading their material, a period of some 2 years or more elapsed before they even began to grapple with the question of the tendencies in the World Labor Movement, especially Stalinism, and only in relation to the development of the split between Mao, between Peking and Moscow. And even there, they, to my knowledge, haven't yet taken any position, official position, on this question. What did they begin with? They began with trade union policy. If you look at the issue number one, volume one, issue number one, January 1962 of Progressive Labor, you will find a statement of policy by the editors. And the statement of policy by the editors is for an alternative labor policy, the trade union question. Now, the trade union question is a very important one, and at times can be decisive. But it is essentially a tactical question, even a strategic one, if you want to consider such questions as whether or not it is feasible to promote the organization and building of a revolutionary union as against the reformist unions that exist now, or raise it in the sense that the IWW raised it, or that the Stalinists raised it during the third period when they said that we must build revolutionary trade unions. It becomes then a strategic question. But essentially, it's a tactical question, the tactical problem, the trade union question, over which there can be many, many differences. And while it can play an important role in the development of any group, it is no substitute for the all-important question of how do you relate to the existing major political tendencies on a world scale? What is your perspective of the world development? Where do you stand on the question of socialism in a single country versus permanent revolution? What is your estimate of the regime in both the Soviet Union, China, and the other Stalinist bloc countries? Because it is the answer to this question that will determine your attitude towards practically every other, including the trade union question, every other question. You see, beginning as they do with this, and this is carried through, I mean, this is not just an aberration. In September 1962, this was January, they finally came out with a statement of policy. And what was their statement of policy on? Trade Union Program Part 1. A statement of policy. In Volume 1, Number 1 of their theoretical organ, also the trade union question becomes the number one question. Now, let's say I sort of puzzled about that and how it can assume such importance unless, as I say, they consider it more than just a tactical question, and it seems that they do, although even here you cannot arrive at any clear conclusion on the basis of what they said. That is, they come out for a second federation of labor, a second trade union federation, composed of the real militants and all of those who have been expelled from the FLCIO, and in order to form a genuine union federation to carry out policies of the class struggle. Now, from the practical point of view, if you took all of the unions that had been expelled from the FLCIO and now exist independently, gathers them together into a second trade union federation, all you would have would be a replica of the existing AFL-CIO. Nothing more. Can you conceive of Jimmy Hoffa, for example, an outstanding champion of the revolutionary perspective for the overthrow of capitalism, the South of socialism, or a Harry Bridges, or any of the others who are now on the outside? So it's that there's no substance to it. You see, at least when the CP in the third period pulled its people out of the AFL and formed what they call revolutionary trade unions, they did it as part, as I say, a part of a world move based upon a completely incorrect perspective, but based upon the perspective that the working class of the entire world was faced with the problem of the conquest of power, that the revolution was right around the corner, that therefore we could not waste time in trying to reform or take over the reformist trade unions. We've got to begin our own, to develop and organize our own combat organization to provide the leadership for the masses who were on the verge of taking power. That's what they meant by the third period. It was the last period of capitalism. Capitalism was on the verge of being overthrown, and therefore. But what is the justification for a second federation of labor today? Certainly their perspective is not outward. I can't even say it's not. But not realistically. The overthrow of American capitalism, that doesn't seem to be on the agenda as yet. Maybe. But as yet, certainly not. Now, it's true that they did deal with some of these other questions that I raised. And I want to quote to you how they dealt with it. Although they've never dealt, to my knowledge, with the theory of socialism in a single country versus the term revolution. In issue volume 1, number 2 of Marxist-Leninist Quarterly, there's a section on the crisis in the world communist movement in which they say, we do not here wish to discuss the present crisis in the world communist movement, which is erroneously viewed by the bourgeois press and by misguided people as solely a dispute between China and the USSR. In this issue of MLQ is an article designed to open discussion of that crisis. So we don't want to deal with this question, but there's an article in here, in this issue, which will open a discussion on the crisis. The opinions expressed in it are the author's, and we expect to publish other viewpoints in subsequent issues. In time, the editors will have a full statement of their own, in time. All right, time passed, that time does. And we have volume 2, number 1, a statement of the National Coordinating Committee entitled, "The U.S. Workers Require a Revolutionary Theory." Good. I might say that in volume 1, number 1, they had a statement in which they say that the pages of MLQ are open to all who share our socialist goal and who are prepared to discuss constructively the many problems vital to the building of a revolutionary socialist movement. Well, availing ourselves of this invitation, I think Ward wrote an article in which I thought was a very objective one, taking up some of the questions they had raised in the course of their discussion in the magazine. Of course, they didn't even see fit. Not only didn't they print it, they didn't even see fit to dignify it by a rejection, a formal rejection. It just probably sank into the editor's wastebasket without even a reply. But the discussion went on. All right, the U.S. workers require a revolutionary theory. And here is the their statement on Stalin and Stalinism. The overriding feature of the growth of socialism in the USSR, they say, was its consistent anti-imperialist line. False. They continue. While one can point to the errors of Stalin and the Soviet leadership in this period, it is generally recognized that there existed a militant revolutionary line. False. It was not generally recognized at all. We have spent years demonstrating that this line of theirs was counter-revolutionary, not revolutionary. And to dismiss it by saying it is generally recognized now is not a very effective means of polemics. It's not going to convince anybody. Then they go on to the development of Browderism, the emergence of Titoism. The Titoism, of course, was revisionism and rejected out of hand. They don't explain why the split or why the revolt of the Yugoslavs against Stalin. And then, briefly in the sentence two, dismiss the theoretical contributions of the Yugoslavs. And then summarize. Stalin and the Soviet Party met this theoretical claptrap head on. They reaffirmed that the gradual and peaceful development from an advanced state with a capitalist economy into socialism is a hoax and a rejection of the basic Marxist position that there can be no socialism without the smashing of the capitalist state apparatus, replacing it with a new state built on workers' power. Then they jump to the 20th Congress and criticize Khrushchev for his total rejection of Stalinism, of Stalin, and of Stalin's true role. They say Khrushchev erred because he did not place both Stalin's enormous contributions and his serious errors in their actual historical context, but offered instead a subjective, crude, total negation of a great Marxist-Leninist and a proletarian revolution. Now, it is true that Khrushchev, in his denunciation of Stalin, did not even attempt a sociological analysis of the development of the Soviet Union, which would explain the rise of a Stalin. How could a Stalin come to power in a state founded upon a social revolution? Their explanation was the so-called cult of the individual, which is a purely subjective one. It had nothing to do with the real sociological development or of the problems which gave rise to this phenomena known as Stalinism. He could not do it. He could not engage in such an analysis because he was part and parcel of the Stalinist apparatus. He himself was weaned in the Stalinist school and rose to power as a Stalinist, committing all of the crimes along with Stalin that were committed in the extirpation of the Bolshevik cadre, which made the revolution. So he could not make such an analysis. But then to criticize him for not using what could only be called the bookkeeper's approach. That is, you draw up a balance sheet, you see, and you put the good things on one side and the bad things on the other. You weigh them in your scale. and then you decide, is it the good things weigh more than the bad things, then you must conclude that he was a great Marxist-Leninist anti-proletarian revolutionist. Now, they have some criticisms of Stalin. For example, they say, in the matter of party and government organization, Stalin did not fully apply proletarian democratic centralism. Well, you'd gather from that that he applied it, not fully, but partially, although they give no example of how this proletarian democratic centralism was applied. They go on, quote, he was in some instances, he was guilty of abrogating it. Mind you, this man and this bureaucracy that destroyed the Bolshevik Party, that in the Moscow trials murdered the flower of Lenin's collaborators, the men who had made the revolution. He was, in some instances, guilty of abrogating. Further, Stalin, they say, was right to suppress the counter-revolutionaries. What counter-revolutionaries? Radek, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Rykov, Bukharin. I'm reading off the names of Lenin's political committee. These were the counter-revolutionaries that Stalin was right to suppress. What counter-revolutionaries? If there's one thing that Khrushchev did, you see, in which they're criticizing him for, is that in the name of the cult of the individual, he said, Stalin, yes, did destroy many innocent people. He didn't say anything about the Trotsky, or even about Zadok and Kamenev and others who were not Trotskyists. But he did say he destroyed many innocent people. They also say, and I quote, many innocent people, or people with differences which could have been worked out in the course of principled ideological struggle, were wrongly killed. I think somebody asked, how do you go about correcting such an error of people who are wrongly killed? And this under socialism. Is it any wonder that socialism, that the Stalinists did more to discredit the very idea of socialism than any other tendency in the world? Then they criticize and they say, you got to determine which is primary and which is secondary. And they're all for the primary and for the subordination of the secondary. And their conclusion is that Stalin's contributions, and I'm quoting, which an overall historical evaluation of his life demonstrate to be primary, are being thrown out. His grievous errors are being perpetuated. And you can go on and on and on. Quote, in initiating and repeating their violent attacks upon Stalin, the present leadership of the CPSU sought to undermine the influence of this proletarian revolutionary among the people of the Soviet Union and throughout the world. In this way, they prepared the ground for negating Marxism-Leninism, which Stalin had defended and developed in order to introduce their own revisionist line. Now, these people have not broken with Stalinism, although I suppose they were resented very much if you characterize them as Stalinists. They have not broken with Stalin. In fact, their criticism is that the Khrushchev break with Stalinism had gone too far in negating this sterling, outstanding Democrat, champion of the rights of the people. Another test was the Hungarian Revolution and the Poznan Uprising, of all tendencies in the world working class movement. On that, they were on the side of Khrushchev in, they were on the side of Mao in saying that that it was only because Mao had put pressure on Khrushchev that Khrushchev sent the Soviet tanks into Hungary to suppress the revolutionary uprising. And they asked this hypothetical question, a rhetorical question, does anyone believe that imperialism would not have taken over Hungary and Eastern Europe if the Khrushchev leadership had not pulled itself together under the advice and pressure of the Chinese party and other communists and responded to the requests of the Hungarian revolutionaries to help crush the counter-revolution? No, that was not so. The workers' councils in Hungary, they didn't call for a restoration of capitalism or a counter-revolution. They made that very clear that they were for socialism. They were against this monstrous bureaucratic caste that had created such a heated regime in Hungary that the workers rebelled and revolted against. Now they had to explain why they split from the American Communist Party. And in their explanation, they don't go into it very deeply. They split from the American Communist Party because it had become revisionist. And they were for a Marxist-Leninist party. And in analyzing the disputes inside of the American Communist Party, which resulted in their leaving the party, they point to Foster and Fosterism as the healthy tendency around which they call all members of the Communist Party to rally. The reason for that, as I conjecture, is that in the struggle following the 20th Congress, which created such a tremendous ferment and resulted in this lengthy discussion and controversy inside of the Communist Party, the division into the two wings, one wing led by Gates and the other by Foster Davis, that they supported the Foster-Davis wing as against the Gates wing, and therefore have had to justify this by trying to create an image of Foster which he really doesn't deserve. Foster was as much a part of the leadership of the Communist Party and as much responsible for their line during the whole period when Browder was the head of the party as after or before. Foster, I remember, was the chief spokesman of the Communist Party during the period of the war, when, because he came out of the trade union movement and was a leader of the trade union movement in the early 1920s, and because they thought he had authority with the workers, the steel workers especially, as he led the big steel strike in 1919, and the coal miners, they sent Foster into the field to preach national unity against strikes for the subordination of the Negro struggle to the victory over Hitler. Condemned John L. Lewis as an enemy of the American people, because he refused to subscribe to the no-strike pledge. He was the chief spokesman and propagandist of the Communist Party during the period when they did everything to subordinate the struggle of the workers against the national unity program of the Roosevelt regime. It was Foster who preached and proposed that the legislation which Roosevelt had introduced for calling for labor conscription, that is, to conscript workers and to send them wherever the state wanted to send them, he, along with the others, came out for support of such legislation. The only tendency in America, even the most right-wing Quakers in the heads of the left, were strongly opposed to labor conscription, the only one. And to say this man is a, how did they, how do they put it? I can't find it here. Anyway, they call upon all young people to emulate William Z. Foster. I've got so much of this marked up, it's almost impossible to find. You have to mark up almost every line, every paragraph. At any rate, he is the one that they point to as the paragon among Marxist-Leninist revolutionary leaders in this country. Now, with that sort of a line, you can't tell the truth about history. You've got to lie. You've got to distort. You've got to pervert the truth. No revolutionary party worthy of its name can be built on the basis of a perpetuation of falsehood. Listen to what they have to say again on the question of the Trotskyists. They talk about the faction fights inside of the Communist Party prior to 1920. In the 1920s, fights with the Lovestone and so forth and so on. And they say not until the end of the 1920s that these factional fights moved to a showdown. In 1928, James P. Cannon was expelled from the CP for supporting Trotsky's left deviationist doctrine. Now, what Trotsky's left deviationist doctrine is, they don't even bother to say. He wasn't supported. He wasn't expelled for supporting Trotsky's left deviationist doctrine. He was expelled for asking for a discussion on the main document of the Sixth World Congress, that is, the world program of the Communist International. And before the discussion, he committed himself, in the name of his group, to abide by the discipline of the organization, to accept the decision of the organization after a full and free discussion. That's why he was expelled. They go on, upon his return, what the left deviationist doctrine is, as this passes all. Because if anything, in 1928, the left deviationist part could only refer to the attack upon the concept of building socialism in a single country, which was the focal point of Trotsky's attack on the program of the Sixth World Congress. After that, do you remember, in 1929, they embarked upon this outrageous, ultra-leftist line, the third period, in which some of the most insane tactics were employed. A Upon his return from the Sixth World Congress of the Comintern, which had turned down an appeal from Trotsky in exile, you know what the appeal was? The appeal was that Trotsky's criticism of the document, of the main document, the program, be circulated to delegates attending the Sixth World Congress. Wasn't that a heinous crime? That's all. And that he be permitted to attend the Congress as the leader of the left opposition opposed to the draft program. Cannon got hold of the document only by accident, only by virtue of the fact that he was on one of the commissions. None of the other delegates saw the document. And the document had to be smuggled out of the Soviet Union by Cannon and by Spector, the Canadian delegate to the Communist International. Turned down the appeal from Trotsky in exile. Cannon began clandestinely. Now, you get the clandestinely? That's underground, you know, subversive-like. Distributing Trotskyite materials. Though Cannon had been a member of their group, Foster and Bittelman preferred the charges against him of disseminating Trotskyite propaganda. And what was the Trotskyite propaganda? Advocating withdrawal from the existing trade unions, abandoning the United Front, and promoting destruction. Imagine. Imagine such falsification of history, advocating withdrawal from the existing trade union. From the very beginning, Trotsky says, you're mad, you're insane. This policy of attempting to establish revolutionary trade unions, withdrawing all your militants from the existing trade union, so this is turned around to make it appear that this policy was one that Trotsky advocated, and that's what they were opposed to, abandoning the United Front. Trotsky's whole years, from almost the beginning of the time that Hitler came to power, was concentrated on trying to break down this idiotic theory of the United Front from below and advocating a United Front. So he was guilty of abandoning the United Front and fomenting disruption. Well, such is history as it's written. Now, see, this is nothing new. They say you can get by slandering, falsifying, distorting, and perverting the views of an opponent. And you may fool few people, but in the end, it's bound to backfire against you. And it characterizes the organization that indulges or engages in this sort of tripe. The radical movement can never benefit. We've had too much of it under Stalinism. And this has been a hallmark of Stalinism, is to first falsify the position of your opponent and then to launch a all-out attack upon the falsified version, not the true version of what your opponent stands for. Now, they've been out advocating the formation of a new revolutionary party. Now, we're all for that. We say before there can be a new revolutionary party, we've always been for it, there's got to be a discussion. And it's got to be an open, frank, free, full, and honest discussion, where both the areas of agreement and the areas of difference are strictly defined and delimited, so that the argument and discussion is about the true position of those who are engaged in the discussion. But that hasn't been their course. They invite discussion and then reject material submitted for the discussion. They hold the discussion, but only within the confines of a very limited group their own, so far as I can determine, because it's in their own internal bulletins, and engage in these internal bulletins in an attack on the SWP. Here's an internal bulletin, a call for a national founding convention, which was supposed to have been called for Thanksgiving, but now has been postponed to Easter, in which this contribution appears. Why a new revolutionary organization? Question by Mort Scheer. Answer by Mort Scheer, rather. He dismisses both the SLP and the CP because they have separated the struggle for socialism from the immediate struggle for the people, as that they've abandoned the socialist perspective. Then he goes on, the SWP also has no future. It was built on two fundamental mistakes. One, it made the focus of its international position the call for a political overthrow, not of imperialism, but the first socialist state. Now, isn't that a falsification, an outright historical falsification? We have always made clear, and we split the party with the Schachmanites over this question, that we were for the unconditional defense of the Soviet Union against imperialist attack. That was why we split the party. That's why we split with the Schachman group. The party split almost in half. The question of the political revolution, the political overthrow. If you say, it really doesn't make sense to me. I try to make sense out of it. All of the criticisms that we've had of Stalin and Stalinism, I cannot even approximate in its virulence the attack made upon the Kremlin, Khrushchev and the others by Peking. Cannot. Just read what they say about the Khrushchevites are the greatest splitters of all time. Read that they've betrayed the struggle, that they've got to be removed, and so forth and so on, up and down the line. Nothing. There's no language that is not tough enough for them to use against the Khrushchevites. These people claim to be Maoists. Do they agree with that? Do they agree with Mao when he calls for the overthrow of the Khrushchev regime? And he does, and still does today. And do they equate that with calling for, that is, identifying that with the attack of imperialism? It's crooked. It's false. Continue to quote, seizing on certain errors of the Bolshevik Party leadership under Stalin, certain errors, they made this the primary consideration when it was strictly secondary. Now you get that, the two legs? You got to always look out for the primary. That's number one. The secondary is number two, and it always comes after number one, both in the arithmetical scale and in politics. One, two, not two, one. The primary task for revolutionaries with regards to the first socialist state was to defend it against the attacks of imperialists. It is of the utmost importance at all times to distinguish between the primary and the secondary aspects of a question. Now that's the ne plus ultra of Marxist-Leninist theory. And we're greatly indebted to these teachers for hammering home this lesson, without which we'd be completely lost. Otherwise, if you don't follow one with two, otherwise your whole direction can not only be wrong, but disastrous for the development of the revolution. This is also true with the correct assessment of individuals who also reflects contradiction. For example, if your estimate of Luther is that he's primarily a good trade unionist interested in the advance of the working class, but who occasionally makes mistakes, then your direction in connection with Luther is one of support with occasional criticism. If, however, your estimate of Luther is that he is primarily serving the interests of the enemy, the ruling class, and occasionally does or says some things in order to stay in control of the Union, then your line with regards to him becomes one of exposing him and getting rid of him. You get it? The parallel? This is clear as split pea soup. When the SWP estimated the Bolshevik leadership under Stalin as not primarily a defender and leader of the revolution, but as an obstacle that had to be overthrown, their orientation led them from the left to coincide with the efforts of the imperialists to overthrow the first socialist state. Now, I say it's slander because I think the writer knows better. I mean, he's familiar enough with our literature to know better. But they face a problem, you see. The problem is that they can't ignore the Socialist Workers' Party or the Young Socialist Alliance when they talk about building a new revolutionary party in this country. Why is it? Why is it that it's 1962 that 3 years have elapsed, 3 years have elapsed since they came out with their first proclamation of an organization, an organ and a paper, and a policy, that they have not yet been able to hold a founding convention, a conference which would adopt a program and set up an organizational form? You know, I talked to one of them, one of the ex-PL people, who came in and saw me last week. And we had thought he was a member of the PL, and we asked him, we assume you're a member of the present labor. He says, I don't know. He said, I belong to a club. And I said, well, what about the other members? And he says, I don't know whether they're members or not. Nobody's ever acted. I've never submitted an application for membership. Nobody's acted on an application for membership. I don't know whether we have membership in the sense that it's understood probably in your organization. I go, well, don't you have any elected committees, elected delegated conferences? Well, all he knows of is that there's a national coordinating committee, and that apparently all the instructions come down from the national coordinating committee, that some people are members, some people are not members, and some people don't know whether they are or not. Well, you would think that they would be at that such a situation should be corrected. The only way to correct it is by holding a convention. And you would think that under the ordinary course of the development for a group of this kind, it was first to hold your own convention. Before you call for a new revolutionary party, you got to decide, what do you stand for? What do we stand for? What is our program as decided by our own organization? Then we can say, all right, here's our program. It's upon the basis of this program that we invite discussion on the formation of a new revolutionary party. We think there's a possibility exists in this country. There are enough revolutionary elements around, either organized or unorganized, to constitute a new and a larger revolutionary party. And we want a discussion. Very good. We would welcome such a discussion. We would say, all right, here's our program. And we'd say, let's discuss. Let's throw everything on the table. Let's discuss all of these questions, theory, strategy, politics, trade unionism, and so forth and so on. And if there exists a sufficient area of agreement, then we can talk about forming a new revolutionary party, because the party's got to be based upon a program. That's where you begin. But it's a hoax to say we're for a new revolutionary party and call for a discussion of it before the group itself has even formulated and adopted its own program, and hold such a discussion as a closed discussion. Then are they going to say, after this discussion, aha, we've got the new revolutionary, American Revolutionary Party, formed out of a broad discussion, which has adopted this program. It's a fraud. And you can't build a revolutionary party on a basis of fraud. No. It's been tried. It's been tried and tried and tried again. It cannot be done. Lenin says you cannot lie, you cannot deceive the workers. It's even worse to attempt to deceive your own members, or to keep it so in such confusion they don't know whether they're in or out, or what they stand for, or whether they have a program, or what that program is. Well, I could go on, but... maybe the questions will enlighten us on some other aspects which I haven't had a chance to cover. It's difficult to say, because Stalinism really bites deep. It's been our experience. It was a very bad school, the worst school of politics that anybody can matriculate in, was Stalinism. And even those who've broken with it have found it very, very difficult to rid themselves of many of the misconceptions and miseducation that they acquired in the Stalinist ranks, and above all, of a sort of a hatred due to the poisonous propaganda disseminated by the Stalinists against Trotskyism and Trotsky. Now, is it all due to that? I don't think so, because judging by what they write, at least their leaders are familiar with our position. That they've read our literature, not all of it, but our programmatic statements, they know what we stand for. And when they engage in this sort of business of falsifying and distorting and perversing, I think it's done not out of ignorance, but out of an attempt to poison their own ranks against the SWP and the YSW. It's a very tricky business when you begin to monkey around with this business of unity and forming a new organization. It's one of those things that you better not maneuver with, because it'll rear up and bite you when you least expect it. The moment you raise the question, you've got to be serious about it. And why? Because the moment they come out at any time with the proposal for a new organization, my view is that we grasp the proposal with both hands and say, fine, we're all for it, let's have a discussion. What are they going to say then? Then we're going to, whether they want to or not, we're going to have a discussion. If we can't have it in their press or in the joint press, we'll have it in our press. And we'll see that our press gets into the hands of their people. And then their people, those who are genuinely want to build a new revolutionary party, are going to have some questions to ask. Why don't we discuss? Why don't we have a discussion bulletin? Why do you lie about these people? It backfires on you. So how much is that aspect? I think that part is due to their stomach. They think that they can maneuver, you know, and get around the consequences of such a course. I don't think they can, because we've had a lot of experience with that. We've gone through genuine reunifications, and we've gone through maneuvers. And it's very easily to distinguish one from the other. Where you're genuinely proposing unification, then the fundamental prerequisite is that you've got to at least present objectively your opponents or your rivals' true and accurate position. You cannot lie, you cannot falsify, you cannot distort, unless you have the power to shut everybody else up, which is a power they don't have.